Welcome to this 115th JBST.com Smartcast, released for April 2013. This is the multi-sport podcast for triathletes, duathletes, sportive riders, road racers, time trialists, runners, mountain bikers, and fitness enthusiasts.
Whatever your distance and whatever your event, this podcast aims to make you smarter and faster.
Thank you for downloading this 115th episode. I'm Coach Joe Beer, and I'm joined once again by Cyfork Racing's Martin Crocker, who has got notes tonight.
I have come prepared, fully stacked and prepared. Hello, Joseph. How are you?
I'm very well.
Very formal this evening. Very formal.
Yes, very formal. Okay, thank you for the recent reviews that have gone up on the iTunes page. If you're new to the podcast, there's some good recent interviews with people like Ironman Phil Graves, with cross-country enduro legend Nick Craig. There's some way back in the library of episodes, such as the Raylett brothers, basically loads of people. The more you go back into it, the more you realize there's been some quite good interviews in between our drivel.
No, how dare you.
How dare you? Right. No. Okay. Brief news. What do we know? What do you know? Come on, Martin.
I know nothing. Apart from the fact
season,
that
the season is underway.
Yes, the weather has got better and the season is underway. Yes. With gusto.
Yes. And this is the time where, despite what's happened to your winter, despite there probably being the odd upset, the odd illness, and maybe even your events or races or challenges have changed, it's still good to reappraise and get out there and do something, because it's a long winter when you're in the Northern Hemisphere, and it is quite good just to get out there and do stuff.
This has been the longest winter, I think, ever. So, especially with kind of the bad summer just rolled into the winter. I think the winter you can accept, but now, fortunately, we're sat here and it's the sun has set. It's beautiful.
The sun has set, and
rather like the sun setting on my career.
Righty-ho. So I think we jump straight in with the listeners' questions. And Martin, because you've got such well-written notes, and he's making like a real kind of victory line salute because he's got the notes written, whose question do you want to start with?
Let's have a look. Let's... Rob Lines.
Rob Lines. Okay, Rob, he sent one in via the Twitter feed. And he said, what benefit or hindrance to training does donating blood represent? Okay, so you fire away with your six penneth.
First of all, if you don't donate blood, you should do. I know it's me saying, right, you've got to go and do it. You don't have to go and do it. But it's just a fantastic cause, and you never know, and hopefully you'll never need to go to have any blood transfused into you.
Yeah,
so.
No, you're on about perfectly legal donation to blood.co.uk rather than giving it to some doctor somewhere who keeps it in a fridge and then says he'll give it to you at the right time.
yeah. So,
but it's under a code name of Frizz the dog or
Pegasus.
Yeah, you're on about go to blood.co.uk and see when you can donate blood.
So the question being asked is it a benefit or a hindrance to training if you donate blood? Well, I think effectively they take a pint, don't they? A pint, isn't it? Yeah, it's a pint. So it does reduce your blood volume, they reckon, by about 10%, which I think is quite a fair bit, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what you've got to realise is they recommend you don't do anything physical for up to 48 hours.
Yeah.
Now, if you're going to race, but you're an avid blood giver, then you need to be looking at it pretty much falling in and around your training if you're that serious with your training.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they look at the drop-off is is quite a bit in performance, but they recommend you shouldn't really do any competing between 7 to 10 days. But then the blood volume gets replaced. It takes up to 4 weeks to replace.
Yeah, it's certainly, and I've donated blood and not played around and experimented. I'm very much of the ilk of if you do it, I think it is a good feeling. I think it is. It's something where...
And you get a cup of tea and a biscuit.
Get a cup of tea and a biscuit. Particularly if you get a bit faint. Whoa, do you need that biscuit? I tell you what, a few times when I've seen that needle go in, it's like, oh, crikey, hold on a minute. But I have, from my point of view, always timed it such that I wouldn't do it 2 weeks before something that that mattered to me. Because I think, no, because then I'm going to be not wanting to go back and do it again. Because I go, oh, yeah, but I did it and it didn't help me. And
ruined my, yeah.
Yeah, and it ruined my, you know, my whatever. And yes, there is a performance drop. There's certainly, you know, and I've used heart monitors and gone off and done stuff. And you notice that your heart rate is raised.
That's
your
right.
Heart rate goes up. It does feel harder. I certainly wouldn't recommend doing anything soon after because your blood sugar regulation appears to be a bit iffy. Hence, you need the biscuit and you often need to eat stuff. But the fact that it takes out the oxygen carrying capacity means heart rate goes up. But it's also why did the dopers put it back in? Because it meant their heart rate and their aerobic ability went up. So if you imagine you're the exact opposite, you can become more anaerobic.
Yeah.
You can have a higher heart rate and you're certainly not going to be performing very well. But 2 weeks later, you should have the majority of that deficit in red blood cells actually replaced.
Yeah.
But I still wouldn't leave it 2 weeks before something that, you know, 2 weeks before training camp, giving blood is probably going to put you in a bit of a stickler. I'd always try and plan to get it done maybe at the very end of your season, maybe when you've just done a race, you haven't got anything coming up and you think, actually, that's a good time for me to do it in, you know, a week or so's after. Watch that you don't pick a time when you've just battered yourself into submission and you're now unwell, because they might say, actually, we don't want you to donate. And I think it's one of those things where, yes, it's a minor hindrance to you and it will affect your very important training program for a few days. But in the grand scheme of things, if you needed that blood, you'd be quite happy about all the people that had done that for you.
Yeah.
And it's all down to planning. I mean, it would be silly to do it at the wrong time and say, oh, I did it 10 days before an Ironman. Was that wrong? I mean, you've got to take into account your considerations as well as the fact you're doing it. You're not doing it and they're saying, there you go, there's £50. Thank you very much. And you're doing it. You know, there's an altruism to it, definitely. But there's also a sense that you're far better to plan it well and then you'll want to do it again. Because if people get affected by it, they don't do it.
That's the thing. And I mean, I did a little bit of reading up, actually.
This isn't going to be one of those long questions that we get irritating emails about, is it, Martin? You're not going to spend an hour on this, are you?
No, this is it. Actually, I'm just reading the last bits of my notes.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah. So a little bit of the studies have shown that performance is hit only with your maximal, that you can't seem to be able to hit the big figures, the absolute 100%ers. But they reckon that's only effective between 5 to 7 days. Right. And then normally drops back after the 7 to 10 days from doing anything absolute. So
right.
You just, if you can do it, if you can donate blood, that'll be brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But if it does affect you in a funny way, which it's going to, then avoid doing it in your high stress kind of parts of training.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if you're on rolling blocks of maybe 4 weeks, you just have to bear in mind, even if you do it on your easy week, you might suffer then for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Before, and that will affect your build up. But, you know, again, if you can do it, like Joe says, in a bit of downtime between seasons or your off season, then brilliant. Go and donate.
And yeah, blood.co.uk, quite interesting to see the levels of blood in different groups. If you're a rare blood group, do it, because there'll be other people that are in rare blood groups. And it's, I think, one of those very simple to do things that it's like having a organ donation and things like that. You know, if it doesn't go against your morals or your religious views.
It's like political, mix of religion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then do it.
Yeah.
Okay, Carl Fanon. I think I've got it right there, Carl. And I know you've said, I'm almost certain that this guy is in Australia, I'm certain, because it's got a plus 61 code. And he said, triathlon qualified for world age groups in London. And he says, hi, Joe and Crocker, I love the podcast. I'm 37, I'm an age grouper, qualified for the Sprint Worlds in September. Oh yeah, I live and race in Australia, moving to the after moving from the UK. I'm now in the off-season looking for the best way to build the bike, i.e. build the bike fitness, over a 20-hour training schedule at its peak. I understand the concept of building base in Z1 and using Z3 carefully to gain peak performance. I aim to train on the bike 10 hours a week. 80% of my cycling is on a wind trainer. Do you have any decent workouts I can use for various zone-specific sessions? And is there a brick session you recommend when doing training peaks? PB for sprint is 57.12. And there was something else about how many high-intensity sets should I include in my weekly plan? I was thinking around 3 sets of 45 minutes. The rest is a mix of strength, endurance, and tempo. Okay. Now, firstly, that, at peak, even for sprint distance, 20 hours, wow. I mean, I'm not going to say you can't do it. You might have done it before. But there's a good chance that that amount of stimulus could be too much for what you're trying to do. Because you can only do so many hard sessions.
Yeah.
So why are you doing so much more work for something that is effectively a one-hour event? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a lot there that I wonder. I mean, at 37, you might be, and you might have a background which I'm not aware of that meant that for you, 20 hours is like a walk in the park. Or it may be you've qualified and now you think, right, I'm really going to go for it and do 20 hours. If somebody said that to me, I would be trimming that back and saying, look, I think you've got to do the high intensity as you build through, pretty much May, June, July, August, September. You've got a 4-month block there to build, but in effect, there's only so much high intensity you can do. Yes, the majority of it, has got to be, controlled work. But if you're trying to improve the performance, you say about, 3 sets of 45 minutes, the rest is strength and endurance. If you're doing 3 45-minute sets, which I can only think he's talking about high-intensity sets, hold on a minute, you've got 2 other sports as well. You can't be doing, even if you did 3 sets of the biking and then did another 1 or 2 in the swim and run, you think, you can't be doing 7 high-intensity sessions per week. That is physiologically impossible. You want to be aiming for 3 hard sessions at most across the disciplines. You've put tempo, though I'd watch that, because although that might be at your race area, it's not the most effective area. It might be quite good for speed of movement and a little bit of kind of near to threshold, but it should not be seen as the place to actually go. And yes, strength and endurance, working on low cadence work on the bike, which can be done on the wind trainer or outdoors, where you work at low cadence and high resistance, but you're not out of zone 1. You'll stay in zone 1 doing that. And look at, if you're trying to improve the bike, 20 hours, that is an awful lot of time. We know, you and I know, and I know other people that are very effective, not only sprint triathletes, but time trialists, and they will do 20 hours in a much further away one-off week in the middle of their winter. And you're now, because of when it is, you've got all of May, June, July, and August till you get to the early part of September. So you've effectively got, roughly 16 weeks. Even to keep it going through that 16 weeks, what you don't want to do is get there and have wrecked yourself. High intensity training or even base building, the fact that you've got to age group level means, you've got a fair amount of talent in age group.
Yeah.
But don't think 20 hours is going to be the difference between making you so significantly better. 57 minutes is really good for sprint tri distance. And 29.12 is good. You're effectively riding at an average speed of 25 miles an hour. You should be using some of that 20 hours to actually find the most aerodynamic bits and pieces and refining your position and looking at your tires, looking at every little tweak to take your drag down and to get you more effective. I know the course in London's hardly an aero course. It's likely to be plagued by, dare I say it, drafting, and it's likely to be something where you're far better to be faster out the water and to get away from people because of the course that is being used. But I don't think that you should consider that to be, I know you said, you know, 20 hours a week and 10 will be cycling. Even for sprint try, there are effective age groupers that don't touch that. And I wonder that some of it is going to be, unfortunately, wasted training. Because if you're doing, even if you were just doing the three sets on the bike, how are you going to also do tempo work and then integrate swimming and stuff like that? It's so hardcore. It's not, I don't see it as producing your optimum performance. And what it will do is probably get you there no better, but likely to have missed the ways in which you can improve, which would be highlighting a lot more on your transitions, your speed of swimming so that you can try and get away from people, and looking at your acceleration ability on the bike because of the nature of the course and how you'll have to accelerate.
The thing that would be interesting is if that 20 hours has been stepped up from when he qualified.
Yeah.
Because by the sounds of it, it's brilliant that you've got that much time, or you've dedicated that much time to do your training. But I think sometimes you've got to have an honest look at your training sessions and go, right, do I really need to be doing 3 hard sessions a week? And then when you go on to threshold, you've got to be very, very specific on where you're going to want to train in that. Because some days you'll feel good, some days you'll feel bad. It'll either go up, it'll drop off, and then you start creeping in. Your zones then start to overlap, and you're kind of thinking to yourself, well, I could go a bit harder here. But then you've still got to do your hard session the following day.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to know whether it's come from doing 10 hours a week and then go, right, I can actually dedicate 20 hours to this.
Because you've qualified, you've already got the talent. And this isn't meant to be an easy, you know, back route to getting to races. But I think people think there's more trainability available than what they've already achieved. Yeah. And it would be a case of saying, you know, where do you feel you can get more time off? If you're doing 25 miles an hour on the bike in a sprint try, which I don't know, you know, whether that's going to be a realistic average speed in London, with the amount of people going on to a course like that, it might be better to have improved your swim speed and get away from some people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you'd never done a race and you said, well, I'm going to the Worlds to race it as part of, you know, not as an age grouper, but as part of the citizens wave, and I really want to do well, but I'm not sure how good I am. You've already proved that you can qualify at age group level. And in Australia, I imagine that's a pretty difficult thing to qualify at. You know, it's not going to be an easy sport. Qualification for age groupers is hard. Mm. It's no longer, oh, it's an easy age group I'm moving up into. There isn't such a thing. Not unless you're in the 100-year-old age group, you know. Yeah. But you could well train yourself worse. And I know that's plenty of people that do it, and they find that it's delivering the quality. What is the limiting factor of that distance? It's very high intensity in disciplines lasting, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and then another perhaps 17 minutes. And that gets you to do 57. So each of those are about tolerating lactate despite working at a very high level. That doesn't mean you have to be at threshold. You have to be way above threshold, able to swim quickly, get away and stay away, to be able to be on the bike and accelerate around corners and be in a very you know, an aero position, but also something that's got low rolling resistance in terms of the bike and the helmet and so on. And then on the run, to be as light as you've ever been, so that when you get off the bike, look at the brownies, look at everyone else that's running fast. They are light. They move very quickly. And, you know, you're probably better to look at your efficiency and the little ways of getting quicker than to think that if you really train hard, that somehow, you know, that 29 is going to come down to 27. As you go faster and faster and faster, to take time off that bike split is going to be very difficult. Yeah. You could be more efficient. You could, you know, spend time within that 20 hours finding out as much about likely temperatures in the UK, about the course and exactly how it's going to be set out, about Not about the competition, because you can't do anything about them, but about your travel to the event, where you're going to be staying in relation to it, and actually put time into it. Most people don't do that, and then they miss the fact that they find out afterwards, oh, actually, it's going to be quite a warm sort of lake that we're in, because it's not really a big open water lake. It's quite small, and the exit ramp's going to be quite steep, and all the little factors that could make the difference in you practicing those last little bits. You know, oh, we're going to have to run with our bike for 400 metres. Right, you need to be able to push that bike, holding the saddle and running barefoot at close to 6 minute miles to get out of transition as fast as possible. If you can't push that bike fast, you're going to be actually jogging out when other people have already got 25 seconds on you because they can push the bike at full speed.
And another thing that would be interesting as well is, you know, the idea of what Joe does is to train smart, you know. It's not to train more. So, you know, you might have come from 10, 12 hours a week and now think, yeah, fair enough, I want to do better, so this has got to be all or nothing. Yeah. But by tossing another 8 hours into it or another 10 hours into it isn't a smart way of doing it.
Yeah.
You know, because training more means more stress on different parts of your system as well for your body.
Yeah.
So you do need to recover more.
Yeah.
So adding more hours to your training isn't going to make you faster.
No.
You know, it may make you fitter, but it will also bring on more tiredness.
Yeah.
It will also you run a higher risk of being injured a lot easier than you would be just doing your normal training. Maybe you can trim the fat off of that 20 hours and maybe take it down. It may be 15 hours, you know, it may be down to 12 hours, but you want to train as smart as you can.
Yeah.
And I know everybody does it. Everybody that's ever been selected for an exclusive team. So like the age groupers, really, you know, you want to be as fit as you can be when you get there, but there's no point in getting there fit, slightly injured.
Yeah.
And tired.
Yeah.
Really?
Look at TNT. Look at your training. And I think if you get up around even the 12 hours to absorb that, unless you can literally go pro, and then you've got to wonder, well, is it in balance going pro for something that's an amateur race?
Yeah.
Put time into, you know, TNT. Okay, training, yes, but training also, are you getting, you know, regular massage? Are you doing things like, you know, deep water running that you can still see as a running session, but it's giving you like an aqua massage and it's something different? Are you then nutrition-wise, are you loading up on the significant factors that can improve your lactate tolerance? And then the technology, have you got, you know, one of the fast Speedo wetsuits? Have you got you know, really good rolling resistance tires? Are you going to know how to get your chain so it runs really smooth? Are you going to be able to know that you've got the right gearing and all those kind of things? Running wise, it's very limited technology. The technology there is, can you be light so that when you run, your mechanics of your chosen footwear work as best as possible?
Yeah.
It's, running is a very simple thing and it does come down to mass. But, you know, spending time on TNT and looking at, you can buy performance. Bikes can be made to make people quicker.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the elites would just say, no, we're so talented, we don't need to worry about that. They get every last little detail sorted so that they are good. And they're certainly not riding on substandard products, because they know that it doesn't matter how much they'd be paid, they would be working too hard. Nobody's got that 10% to say, it's all right, I can have an unaero, heavy, but, you know, but quite lucrative bike I ride. They've got to ride very good equipment. Yeah. And I think that 20 hours should be thought about across all of your, you know, the time to get, you know, the time to spend on your diet and on your, you know, your relaxation, your visualization. Training of that 20 hours, some of it could be mental training, just sitting there and working out, you know, what you understand about the course, about the likely, you're used to training in Oz and you're going to come to the UK September. The early part of September could be
snow.
Right, it could certainly be wet and not very...
Certainly be wet.
Yeah. And, you know, and it would be, you know, different in handling perspective on the bike. You'd have to then know what's the optimum tire pressure for your tires and for the course. Could you in any way, you know, use some of that time to just get yourself really knowledgeable about what is a race that, you know, it's not the 100 metres where it's just 100 metres in a straight line. There will be very intricate details about the London Triathlon that you need to go off and find out, or find that your team manager can find out and actually know about the event. The event is, you know, supposedly 750 meters, 20K, 5K, but those things can change. And I don't know how, you know, how exact it will be to the actual Olympic event, but it's likely that the devil is in the detail, and some of the things that you can find out about that could change the way you train and the way you think. It's not just a swim. It's a swim where everybody around me is as quick as me. I've got to be able to get away from them and then use speed ahead of the group, or I sit on the group and then I, you know, and then I accelerate. But you cannot think that, you know, nobody else around you isn't going to be good. They're going to be as good as you, if not, well, in some cases, there. Better, because they may well be homegrown, raced it on a demo race, know what it's like when it's cold, have sorted out their gear so that they're not stood around getting cold. All these little details that have nothing to do with you've got to train 20 hours.
Well, what I say, that's actually a good point, because you might have, again, you might have donated, we're just speculating, but you might have donated another 5 to 8 hours to this. That 5 to 8 hours every week right on up to your event will count for squat diddly. If you rock up at the race and it's pouring down with rain, you're freezing cold, you've gone as hard as you can, you start to suffer from cramp, you know, your tires are in bad conditions, you've got the wrong pressure in them. I know it is a lot of guesswork with tire pressures, but you know, you rock up with a shoddy pair of tires, that extra 8 hours you've chucked on a week, or have done extra a week, 5 hours, 8 hours, whatever, you know, counts for absolutely nothing if you haven't done your homework.
Yeah.
So, you know, but good question though.
Yeah, yeah, you're probably, I would say to people, you're probably, if you're training and you've got to the level that you have, you're probably closer to your peak than you realise.
Yeah.
And just watch you don't bring it on too quick and then get there and go, yeah, I went all the way, but I was a bit injured and this, that, and the other. Leave the best effort for the start of September.
That's right. And there's nothing, it's such a balancing act.
And come and see Crocker.
Yeah.
Because it'll put you up for the night.
I think, if you can sleep in a bath, it's all right, it's all right. But yeah, just don't leave anything to chance, but just have a serious look at your training schedule and think, right, can I trim fat off this 20 hours?
Yeah.
Because I personally would think that's just a touch too much time.
Yeah.
But okay. Good luck. Anyway, good luck.
And guess what? This is another question from the Southern Hemisphere. Excuse me. It's from Paul Moss, road cyclist, ex-runner. Does about 6 to 8 hours a week, he says, and I'll go through this quickly. He says, hi Joe, I'm sure he meant hi Joe and Martin, I'll add that bit in, otherwise Martin gets really worried. I've read your article since way back, thank you very much. Did my first duathlon in 1992 and I got lapped by Spencer Smith on the Fairford Aerodrome. I'm 41 years old, easing back into fitness, 68 kilos, 177 metres tall, and does a 120 half marathon PB. He's been using a heart monitor since the early 90s. So what's the problem? Despite being 41, my max heart rate on the bike is 200. I can hit relatively easy by warming up and then gunning it up a mild incline. My conversation spinning along pace is about 150 to 160. 165 it's headwind. And I'm averaging 25 kilometres an hour. Slow, as he's put, not me. I don't claim to be fit at the moment, but I've always been a high beater. I could do long runs of 2 hours at 165 beats per minute and not bat an eyelid. I can climb mountains at 185 beats per minute and maintain it. Okay. Doc tells me after X-rays and ECGs that I have a small heart. I just thought that was like, you know, got a small heart. Yeah. You know. You'd be surprised how gutted I felt hearing that. Dreams of athletic endeavour faded before my eyes. They do after 40, don't worry.
Bless you.
So presumably it's beating faster than usual to push the required volume of blood, if that's how it works. I read about guys doing zone one and sitting at 130, 140. I do that rolling off down the road when I'm starting out. I sat at my desk, my resting heart rate is 75, I've averaged 72 all morning. So I'm not super fit, but okay, I'm a high beater. And so to my question, how can I use the zones, which I'm a fan of, I love data, if I struggle to fit within them, yet, given my age and max heart rate, feel as if I'm trying to achieve something I'm probably not suited for. I hope this makes sense. I'm a Brit living on the small island of Tasmania off Australia. Great biking here, birthplace of a certain Richie Port. Tassie cyclists fear not incline or weather, apparently. love the show. Listen and absorb every word. You have the right mix, please don't change anything.
Thank you very much.
So,
I didn't mention me, sorry, Joe.
I'll add Martin to the answer. I mean, one of the things is it's very personal, and you know, it says max heart rate on the bike is 200. I hit it relatively easy by warming up and then gunning it up an incline. That probably still might not even be max, because you know, people don't hit max up an incline unless they fall off and semi comatose. Max is max, and I reckon you've got more beyond that. Most people don't get to within 10 of max on the road. Okay, so let's make a better assumption that it's about 210. Okay, that puts you at about 165 for the top of zone one, and hence, you know, 2 hours at 165 might be a fair enough assumption. But don't worry about the resting. That might again be because of a smaller heart, it beats a bit faster at rest, and it doesn't affect you. You can use the zones, but for you, don't worry about, you know, people sitting at 130, 140. There's plenty of people that sit below that and it's their personal levels. You know, there are people with maximums of you know, just into the 160s, but that's just the nature of them. If we said that your top of zone one was 165, well, okay, that's what you've got to do. And what you don't do is you don't actually try and overdo that. If you do, then what you'll do is overtrain, and you'll end up going not necessarily a lot harder, but you'll sort of, I think people lose faith in it and go, oh, I can't go this slow, I just go faster. But the moment you go faster, you're not going to be able to keep keep it up, or certainly sustain any long-term gains. And all that happens is for the short term, oh, I slowed down a bit, but I couldn't hack it. You've got to say, right, certainly on the bike, and you say now cyclist, I'm assuming you say ex-runner, so assuming that you're just doing biking, you just say, well, okay, if you know that you've hit 200, then that means that, yes, I guess that some of it is you've been a high beater. And when you talk about running, you were at 160, 165. The thing is that your max on the run would have been higher again. So I think you make the not massive leap of faith and say, I reckon 165 is the maximum in zone one. So you just train up to and including that. And the more you do that, the more you increase your fitness. And then if you do the climbs at 185, okay, yeah, that's your climbs and that's your hard work. But sometimes what happens is when people have a higher heart rate, they just think that they're just going to have a higher heart rate, and they ignore it when it goes even higher again by the fact that, oh yeah, mine always goes fast. Yeah, but still it shouldn't go out of zone one unless you're trying to get it out of zone one. And you're going to have to stick to this 165, or if you can, go somewhere, get on a university study or get somebody that's does tests or is a coach that can do a max test based on power. Not so you have to work on power, but just so you get the right steps of increased effort through the test, and go and do a max test and get your real number and then work back from there.
Yeah, I think sometimes what people tend to do, you are what you are and you have what you've got. That's it.
What you tell yourself every morning, isn't it, Martin?
It's a miserable existence. But if you're a high beater, you're a high beater. There's nothing you can do. It is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so if you've got a mate that goes, oh, I don't know how you can hit that. I only hit 165 is my absolute max. I know someone that beats 167 is the max. And not being funny, it must have a giant heart pumping it around. Yeah. It's just, it is. I mean, I'm not far off. I'm 198 as a max for mine, like a racing max. So mine tends to beat faster, but I've got a slightly lower resting heart rate purely because of, I guess, could be because of my age. So, but you are what you are. Mm. So once you work out your zones, like you said, it should all be relative.
Yeah. And these zones don't bring the high beaters down to lower beaters and get the lower beaters upwards.
It's not level.
Yeah. No. Max is max. It is unlikely to actually change. The one thing you can find with cycling is some people find that as they get stronger in the legs, it's not even that they can push the heart more. It's just that they get less worried about the heart rate because now it takes them so much work to get their heart rate up. It's almost a chicken and egg process. Yeah. But if you absorb the fitness, whatever you can do and stay in zone one is whatever you can do and stay that's in it. Zone one. Is that's that you said? And that's yeah. it. And it might be that your nose breathing saying, "Oh, I'm at the top of my zone one, and you know we're riding along." But you know what? The person next to me is only at 140. But that's totally individual. It's not, heart rate is not a comparison. If you were talking percentage wise, yeah. that would make sense. That's if they say, "Oh, I'm at 65%, but you're at 78%." Well, okay, so they must be fitter at that point in time, or riding a lighter bike, or they're sat behind you and they're out the wind and you're in the wind. I think it's important to do your training, and then you should notice that average speed starts to increase, because by the sounds of it, you've possibly let the heart rate go, because you've always said I'm a high beater. But high beata does not mean that you go past the 80% of max. High beata just means your 80% of max is much higher than mine, yeah. and therefore you will have bigger numbers than most people that you train with. But that's your numbers, and that's knowing that's what you got to do. If you spend the majority of time below that 165 point, what you get will be whatever is coming your way. But the fact you've done a 120 half, you know, that's a fairly solid runner's yeah. time. A lot of runners don't get into the 120s. So, yes, there are, you know, plenty below that. But it would say that given that you train aerobically, you work also on big gears to train your strength. So you're not only yeah. training your heart, you're training your legs to be stronger. And you do, you know, a nice 7% incline at 60 revs per minute for maybe 4 to 6 minutes and really get used to grinding a gear out. You can get stronger over the coming years. You can find that you're aerobically fitter. And lo and behold, you're still able to have a high-ish heart rate, but you get fitter and you get stronger without getting worried about high numbers or thinking, well, when am I going to get low numbers? Yeah, you won't get it. Low numbers. No. You've got a small heart, and that's the way it is.
That's it. That's the thing. So it is effectively, you are what you are. Your zones are your zones. I mean, I suppose sometimes we're fortunate and we're unfortunate because of the kind of the work we do and the lifestyle we have. You know, we have to train on our own pretty much. And I would say probably 50 to 60% of people that train, you know, in excess of maybe 8 hours a week yeah. probably train on
yeah.
their own,
yeah.
which is good, because you then don't get pushed on. You don't, you know, it's only your ego then that pushes you on.
Yeah.
And no one's looking over your shoulder going, well, what figures have you got then? What figures, you know, what percentage is that? You know, you'll just stick to your percentages. But then the downside being to that is, as soon as you do get in a group and you're having a good laugh, you get drawn along, and then your numbers go up and people go, "Oh, look at your heart rate, look at your
yeah,
heart rate."
Yeah.
And then you think something's wrong with you. But it's just, some people have got really big hearts with really low heart rates. Some people are fitter, so their heart rate maybe is a little bit low. You know, and some people just beat really fast. So the thing is not to be drawn into the what's my figures, what's your figures yeah, kind yeah. of battle.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have what you have and you've got what you've got, and they're yours. It's no yeah. one else's, it's yours.
Yeah. So yeah. And unless you can prove otherwise from max test data, from nose breathing data, from a, you know, a 40 kilometer heart rate test or something like that, unless you can break your zones sort of model,
yeah,
that's your zones. And if somebody else is different, well, they're different. But if you've got a 205 max or possibly 210, then that's it. That you do 80% of that as the top of your zone one, and that might be, say, you know, 165 166. Well, that's above my threshold.
Yeah.
So, you know, what he's doing in base training, I'm thinking, crikey, that's me absolutely flat out, you know, for an hour.
Yeah.
And that's the differences. But one's chalk and one's cheese. You yeah. don't compare like for like.
That's the thing.
So. Come on, Martin, you got some notes over there.
Oh, I have a tweet from it just says beef.
Beef.
At It's Beef. And it says, "Coach Joe Beer, question, how would you monitor/amend training volume and possibly balance of the three disciplines for a ( Clydesdale triathletes?"
Yeah.
So what I mean by Clydesdales are slightly bigger, voluptuous. I like the word voluptuous. Slightly bigger triathletes. So
yeah. I didn't actually go off and There was like a resurgence, not resurgence, even kind of a starting out of the whole Clydesdale. Probably, I reckon it came just after the Olympics, as more people got into it and they kind of reclassified it. And it sort of went quiet. It didn't, you know, there's not, I don't know of anybody in the UK that's approached me and said, look, I'm racing Clydesdale. At all. Anybody saying that at all. I think it's mostly a US thing.
So you're saying this is a category?
Yes.
I've missed that completely.
Have you?
Yeah.
Right.
But I know what.
Don't tell me. You think it's three disciplines for Clydesdale. You're thinking you're trying to give him some kind of training for Scottish athletes.
Well, the reason why, obviously, I know Clydesdale's a horse, isn't it? It's I was going to say a brand of horse. It's not a brand of horse.
It's a breed.
It's a model.
It's a model. It's a new version.
But also, Zip did a
Clydesdale
yeah. wheel,
yeah.
didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Built stronger.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yes, I understand. I didn't realise, though, that it was a Clydesdale was a category.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is... As far as I'm aware, and as I said, it's not something that I know that much about, because nobody's actually, you know, more people have said to me, I've got a lottery ticket to do Kona, will you coach me, than have ever said to me, I'm a Clydesdale, can you help me?
Yeah.
That's the, and you know, and people think it's rare to get a ticket to Kona. It's even rarer to hear the phrase. So it is very much of a, I think of an out of UK thing, because I don't know of people that race it. It might be possible, there might be a whole underground scene that I'm unaware of, but it would tend to be that, you know, the athletes are, I think, you know, they. I don't know how exactly you classify somebody, because let's say it was, you know, £300 or £250, what it is, how do you know that some of that is mass and some of that is body fat? And if it is, fine, but clearly the more muscular ones that are ex-bodybuilders are going to do better than somebody that's overweight. But how do you actually amend the training volume and balance of three disciplines? Well, you've got to look at, you know, the old strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats. The threat with heavy athletes is the same as a lot of athletes, yeah. Which is the running injury bias. You are hitting the floor harder, even if your body has become used to running, you still have potentials for injury. If you've come from a running background and you've been a Clydesdale runner, that would be quite amazing, because most people that run lose mass, even if they're quite well built.
Yeah.
It drops off, even if they're quite muscular. That's why running's a great stimulus for weight loss. So I think you've got to be very careful about the injury proneness that being a Clydesdale could give you. On the bike, you've clearly got to, you know, you've got to see it as the one where you can probably do more volume without less impact. But you've also got to look at the fact that, you know, not even the volume of balanced swim bike run, the fact that your bike, like you said, Zip wheels are Clydesdale, you might well have to consider what, you know, what components and what, you know, wheels, and, you know, get 25mm tyres so you can ride. Because if you're, you know, over 100 kilos, you need a lot of tyre, not at a super high pressure, but a lot of tyre in order that you can ride comfortable, you can corner and so forth. The swimming, you know, it shouldn't make a massive difference. You would still, if you came to me, be looked at in terms of your potentials across the sports, not necessarily you're a Clydesdale, here's the special formula. It would be, right, what is your history in running? Because that's the potential one where it's the last discipline, you're heavy, you hit the floor hard, and one thing about hitting the floor hard is that it's not very good for long-term development, not only of your running, but of your biking. And so, you know, how would you monitor it? Well, you'd monitor it like anybody. You write a diary and you have it very slowly integrated. And, well, I'm going to hand you over to the world's expert at Clydesdale Triathlon.
First of all, this is sport, isn't it? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter your age, your shape,
he's thought about this. This is. I tell you what, I've never heard you be politically correct, ever. I tell you what, if the microphones were on sometimes, whoa.
But this is the whole thing about sport. It's the fact that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what sport you want to do, what shape you are, age, religion, you know, the colour of your skin.
Sorry, carry on.
You know, you can do a sport.
Yeah.
This is sport. I love it. This is brilliant.
I know. But can I get a piece of research in a minute and get as excited as you just got?
I'm sorry. I just made
this
sure
is sport.
Because
But then you're the man who's gone to watch darts, haven't you? And you've got really excited about watching darts.
Yes. I just things fascinate me. I weigh anywhere between 66 to 68 kg, which is nothing.
Yeah, anywhere between those two quite tight time frames.
Approximately.
Time frames, weight frames.
But so I think, and all you see on telly, it's the same thing as like supermodels. You never see a big
voluptuous
supermodel. You never see a stocky or a larger person doing things like triathlon.
But I would argue there are some lean, stocky athletes.
Yes, but if you went up to me and said, are you a Clydesdale? They'd more than likely punch you, wouldn't they?
Yes, yes.
But this is the thing about sport. Anyway, I'm getting off one. What I would say to you is, you know what you can do, and you know how much you have to do. So I'd be honest with yourself to not to push it so hard that you're then going, well, I'm really enjoying it, but I can't run. I can't run anymore. You know, I can only do one session a week. I can only do two sessions a week.
Yeah,
That's it. That's all I can do. You know, so number one, you do have to bear in mind that there are going to be limitations because of the size, because of your size.
Yeah.
So, but you have to take the precautions that you need to take. And that is, have you got a decent pair of running shoes? You know, they're not inhibiting you, but they're also helping you, you know. Number one.
They're probably changed more regularly because the force is going through them.
They break down quicker.
They break down. And, you know, people shouldn't have running shoes that are a year old and think that that's okay. You've got to change running shoes, I would say, about once every 6 months, to be honest.
Yeah, at least.
What's to be lost? It's not like it's a set of rims on a bike or even a set of goggles in swimming that can last you, you know, several years.
Yeah.
This is running shoes. They are a temporary tool and then you get rid of them.
Yeah.
Or you do the gardening in them, or you use them for going to the gym in to do your weights, but you don't stay in them for a long time. That's my biggest thing with people that are heavy. Don't scrimp on your running shoes.
That's the thing.
What's number two on your list?
I've put on here...
Number two.
Training diary.
Is this two part one or two part AC?
There's probably three parts to it.
Is there? Okay.
Yeah. So for kind of part one, I've put training diary. So you need to log and obviously monitor what you're doing. So even if that's using things like Garmin, Training Center, you know, Strava's a bit of a game really, isn't it? So, but at least you can look on
it's
that.
It's a mind game.
You know, and different kind of training diaries that you can download.
Power Agent.
Yeah, Power Agent, everything.
iSmartTrain.
So iSmartTrain is actually really good, funny enough, Joseph.
Yeah, because you use a MacBook, don't you?
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Dragged you into the 21st century eventually.
Only just. So you need to monitor what you're doing. There's no two ways about it. So a training diary would be brilliant. Amending training volume... I think you know how much you can do and how much you can get away with to be fit and to be safe, as in injury free.
Yeah, and consistent. Not what you can get away with. What can you do for a very small period of time, but it only, you know, locks you down for a few weeks. What can you consistently do?
Yeah,
which is what a lot of people don't know. They're always looking for that big week. No, you just want consistency, you know.
And the thing is with consistency as well is you can measure it. And what I've put here is more info doesn't mean better informed.
Oh,
that is a nugget.
That is a golden nugget. Anybody listening then will be rushing towards pen and paper and writing it down.
Yeah.
So, say it again, Martin, just say it again for that whole... Go on.
More info doesn't mean better informed. So basically...
Where'd you copy that from?
I didn't take... I wrote that down myself. I might have had a glass of wine at that time.
Yeah.
But... you can get lost in all the data that you've got.
Oh, people do. So, absolutely.
So, again, being better informed, you want to pick the pieces out of that data that you think you would need to make a note of, or you need to amend then that part of your training.
Mm.
Because even if you're the world's best versed Clydesdale athlete, that's what I'm going to do now, you still have to make amendments for things. And I also wrote... life is what life is. So effectively...
Yeah, that was a genius, that one, wasn't it?
Go on. That one, another one.
What's that, straight out of the Beatles, is it?
I don't know where I got that one from, no. Again.
But yeah, life changes around you, so yeah. you always have to adapt.
Yeah, so, but the biggest thing that you are armed with is your diary. So you can go, oh, I didn't do too well at that at my key event. Look back through your diary and go, I think that's where it went. Yeah. That's where it went wrong. So you are armed with this knowledge. So again, you can alter what you think you can do. Yeah. But I think all in all, I wrote assess workload. So, you know, what your job is, family life, and health. So, you know, with this training log, you can work back from your goal event and map out your training. You can then amend that as you go along.
Yeah.
Because you can only be honest with yourself. You know, if you end up with niggling injuries, you can't do maybe a particular discipline where you'll have to back off a little bit. Mm. But you'll then know that if you've reached that point where you're getting injured, you know, you maybe the couple of weeks before it or a month before it, you've gone just a little too hard at something.
The diary should be able to predict performances. If people look at performances and work back, you can normally say, yes, that is what it shows. But it's when people are training and they're imagining that somehow there's going to be, a different thing happen when it comes to the crunch time, as if somehow it's going to be, I don't know, the training's like this, or this, but somehow it's going to be exceptionally different on race day. And actually, what you get on race day, look back, that's what you deserved, for the most part, unless there's a real, surprise, which not many performances are actually affected that much. No. But eventually, what you notice is the writing was on the wall, or it was in your diary, and you just have to sometimes be honest with yourself. And this is everybody. This is in Clydesdale. This is everybody. Look, don't expect surprises if your training hasn't been surprising. Yeah?
Do you like that? I like what you've done there.
Yeah? And most of the time it shouldn't be. You know, if you measure somebody or I see things, rarely do people do stuff and I'm flabbergasted at where it came from. Because their performance, their wattage, their speed or whatever, it's like, yeah, there's only, with all the technology, with all the nutrition, with all the training, I think it'll make a certain difference, but it's not as big a difference as what some people's imaginations are. Some people's imaginations is somehow, yes, if you were a Clydesdale and you lost a significant amount of weight, you'd run faster, without a doubt. But after a while, they probably plateau off, and if they've got a very high lean mass, that's it. They're not going to then suddenly go down to Gabri Selassie weight and be, running 204. So there isn't a surprise. It's actually surprising most of the time that people are shocked by what they get is, well, I'm sure it would have been more different than that. Well, no, look at what you've done before. Look at your training. Normally, you can predict when somebody's on a roll and it's going well, but they still don't normally bring something out in a race that you think, I would have never thought that to be possible, because you've only got physiological parameters that you're working in and the developmental amount that people can do. Look at studies of people's training, look at the studies of intervals, look at things like that. People with the best supplement might add on 15 watts. Yeah. People with the best intervals might add on 25 watts at threshold. People dropping weight might run this much quicker per mile, but none of it is outside of a formula.
No, that's
This is what you've got to look at. You've got to be no different beef to anybody else. You've got to have, a plan. You've got to amend it. You've got to look at, what's going to help you be a long-term triathlete so that you can really enjoy it and not break yourself trying to do a training plan that was made for, Chrissy Wellington or Alistair Brownlee. You've got to be realistic in being consistent. And after a while, you'll find your particular formula.
That's it.
And there'll be little bits that you hear about you can add and stuff. But a lot of it is quite commonsensical, really. And I think it's about, not getting too wrapped up in almost starting to turn it into like a job with a massive spreadsheet that's super complicated. Yeah, you've got to note things down. And yeah, I use a spreadsheet type application for people to put stuff down, because it adds stuff up, it can be accessed, but I wouldn't want people to to go overboard. It has to be what their thoughts are, what their data is, and we can look back, and you can look back to see where the surprises were,
yeah,
because it had already been shown, oh yeah, that's going up, great, you're on a roll, or it's not coming out, well, it wasn't there anyway.
Yeah.
Training makes a small amount of difference. If you're untrained, yes, but if you're heavy, you're always going to have limiting factors to your performance, but that doesn't mean that you can't be consistent, that you can't enjoy it, and you can't be your best expert on working out how you can balance, you know, the high intensity with the high impact, the days when you work on transitions to the days when you work on just getting out there and, you know, getting some miles under the bank. There's a lot to be said for just trying to sort out how the hell do you do triathlon without trying to think, you know, what special formulas are there.
Yeah, yeah.
You're doing three sports. You're doing three sports with transitions. You're trying to do it efficiently. You're trying to know what the event is so that you can best be geared for that particular event. And I think that, you know, it's good to put in the Clydesdale thing, but don't think you're exceptionally different to most other triathletes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So again, to monitor, I think, you know, use things like your heart rate monitor. If you have to, a simple stopwatch works quite nicely as well. And also things like your Garmin or anything like that. And then if you need to amend it, only you will know when you need to amend. Because either you've got picked up an injury or you've gone a bit hard on a training week and you just think, oh, this week I can't do it. Yeah. So, you know, once you kind of get into your training program, you'll know your own limitations if you don't know them already. And like Joe was saying, there's not a particular formula, but you might be able to work out your formula that works best for you.
Yeah, so, yeah. And thanks, Beef, because you've given me a great idea, by the way. I will say no more than that. It's given me a great idea.
Is it on beef?
No, it's just Beef.
That's no, but it is your idea on Beef? Not Beef, but as in
No. Right, another question. It's from Alex Knapp. He says, running and duathlon, in brackets, novice. And he says, everyone knows about weight management. This is random. This, I don't know where Beef's from, actually. I didn't actually follow up to find out where it is, but I reckon he's from the States. I've just got this thing. With his writing and how it is, I reckon it might be. But this guy's Alex Knapp. I'm not sure where he's from, but he says, everyone knows about weight management and the benefits in terms of times, but I need to get stronger. Calorie deficit is required to lose weight and calorie surplus to gain muscle. How do you find a happy medium to get stronger and lighter? Martin Crocker, you have 1,500 words.
I don't know.
Discuss.
Four, I think.
Discuss.
That is a difficult one because you. I mean, you know, when you drop weight off, when is enough? If you know what I mean, how much weight off is enough?
Yeah.
And the downside with losing weight is yes, you have. It's a simple mathematical equation: calories you put into the calories you burn. Basically equals weight, doesn't it? So if you burn what you put in, you stay pretty much the same, but you can lean that off. The only thing is I mean, I found protein works for me. I mean, obviously why you need protein is just obviously it's needed for cell replication and cell repair. So I find the good thing about protein is if your body doesn't use it, it doesn't store it as fat. Am I right in saying that?
It certainly takes a lot of energy to try to make it into fat. It's very difficult. It's a very difficult process to break it down, and it's more easily goes into a pool of sort of the protein pool, the amino acid pool.
Yeah.
You can still overeat protein, but the advantage is it's very difficult to overeat protein without going to real excess.
Yeah, that's
but protein thing. Has a high level of satiation. I.e. like when that. You have it, it actually keeps you from feeling hungry because your body's got a raw material there that it can directly use to keep you in a positive amino acid balance.
Yeah.
So even though you haven't taken in full calories, the fact that you're in a positive amino acid balance is a good thing. And the thing with Alex, you know, you're running in duathlon. Actually, you said about, you know, you need a calorie surplus to gain muscle. I'd probably argue you don't necessarily need a calorie surplus to gain muscle, because no. you're probably unlikely to be needing to gain muscle. Yes, you need quality protein for constant repair and to not build muscle, because very rarely do people gain, I mean, you know, very high,
this is the gray area.
Yeah,
this
very
is
the gray high area, level yeah. resistance training, when people are training super hard, maybe 3 days a week, doing maybe, you know, 3 to 4 hours of very high intensity weight training, and they're taking in you know, quality protein sources on top of a good diet. Yes, they can gain lean mass, and it does go up, but it doesn't go up that much. You see how hard they have to work to gain it, and that's really as an end result. To gain lean mass shows that weight training gives you lean mass.
Yeah.
There's plenty of people, particularly runners, cyclists, triathletes, that do hard resistance training. They do it for multiple months in the off season and in the season, and yet they do not end up being what they would term muscle bound
yeah.
or overly, you know, because you're doing so much other stuff that is catabolic. What it encourages is keeping muscle around that you need. It encourages your body to be in a, if you like, in an anabolic state, because you feed it as you do the weight training, but you don't need to be on a really calorie surplus diet to gain weight, because for a duathlete and a runner, you don't actually, you want to make the muscle stronger, but only leave around what is required for what you do.
But do you think sometimes people confuse building muscle with just strength?
Yes, exactly.
They
yeah.
confuse
yeah.
the two.
Yeah. You can get muscle fibers to effectively wake up and fire more effectively. You won't increase the cross-sectional area of that muscle. It will stay the same size, but it will be able to generate yeah. force more effectively. And it may well be that if you train hard enough in the effective exercises of biking and running, you can actually get rid of muscles that might have been around from when you just used to go to the gym or you used to swim. So the more that you do give your body quality protein and quality training, your body will morph into the best runner or duathlete that is possible, assuming that you're doing it. No, to get any muscle gain, you've got to be pushing a muscle quite hard. There are plenty of, you know, interval studies where nobody's really shown a massive change in the muscle, and even weight training, they don't really notice that much of a significant change in the sort of if you like the structure of athletes. They haven't done it that much. There's not been many studies where they said, look, we're going to stick them in a, you know, in a CT scan, and we're actually going to see how much change there is in the body of this athlete and how it affects their performance. I can imagine at the elite level, they should really have them in there saying, have they got stuff that they don't need? Because functionally, if you're a runner, i.e. duathlete, we've said before, weight is the most important factor. You don't want to be any heavier than is necessary to run, but you're going to need to be strong on the bike to be able to push. But there's plenty of quite skinny-legged people who can run okay, and they're certainly not weak. So don't mix big muscles with always producing more power. Yeah, they probably can produce more, but if you're a runner, i.e. more of an ectomorph, you don't need to produce massive power. You want to be stronger, but you'll move away from being a runner's shape if you want to do duathlon, because you need to be more cycle-orientated. However, that doesn't mean that you have to be on a calorie surplus diet to gain lean mass, because there's a good chance that it won't be lean mass, it'll be fat mass. If you do strength training, you give your body enough quality protein, it will add on enough muscle to do the functions, but the functions have to be specific, i.e. you have to do high-intensity, you know, biking and running, and potentially strength training. But you say, you know, I need to get stronger. Well, is it just as a runner, you've just not had enough time developing the neural system to push the pedals harder? Because runners normally can't. And if that's the case, well, you've got to get used to this, you know, 60 rev over geared work, really try and get your legs stronger. And some people say, oh, it takes the edge off my running. It will. As a duathlete, you're not a runner. Most runners can, you know, most runners who totally focus on running will be able to outrun most duathletes, because the duathlete has to be heavier. They are still cycling.
Yeah.
They're not just a pure runner. So you might gain a little bit of mass, but boy oh boy, does a little bit more mass generate more power on the bike? And yes, there's a really difficult balancing act then. What is the optimum physiology for a duathlete? Well, it certainly isn't a heavy cyclist physique, but it certainly isn't the skinny runner physique.
No,
you look at the duathletes, they're smack bang in the middle, and they will be strong. They will want to be low in body fat. They will want to be specifically strong in cycling and running muscles. They won't want any extra upper body because that's a waste of time. But it is important to make sure that you don't get worried about, oh, I need to lose weight, but also I need to gain muscle. If you lose fat mass, it's quite possible at the same time to be gaining just a more strength-orientated physiology without you thinking that you're going to start bulking out.
That's the thing, is people get obsessed with the fact that, you know, I won't go to the gym and do too much weight because I don't want to bulk up. You have to be on a specific diet and a training session or training sessions, and you have to be going probably 5 times a week. You know, to bulk up like that.
But also 3 to 5 times a week, but training really hard.
As in the
heavy reps,
stuff. Yeah.
4 rep, 6 rep, 8 rep max stuff, where you are literally, you know, you're doing high intensity training. That's the only way you will stimulate muscle, is to train so bloody hard that you won't accidentally do that if you're doing duathlon training.
No.
You haven't got the chance to do it, because every time you go out and run and bike and do endurance training, that will be a catabolic process. The hardest part with endurance athletes is actually ever really gaining lean mass. It's very uncommon for them to gain lean mass.
Yeah.
They can be stronger. They can say, wow, the stuff I do in the gym, I've gone up, you know, the total volume I can do in the gym has gone up, the weights I can push has gone up, and I feel stronger, and sometimes muscles feel bigger. But I look in the mirror and I'm the same, and nobody's been saying, wow, you lift weights. It just doesn't happen.
That's it.
You know,
the
anabolic stimulus to gain weight muscularly is very difficult. And even with your quality protein diet, your additional quality protein through shakes and stuff, and making sure you rest enough to absorb that, it's still a very difficult hormonal environment to keep really well on top of.
Yeah.
So difficult that what happens is somebody goes along, lifts some weights, they get that that sort of swelling, the edema in the muscle, and they feel like, wow, my muscles have got really big, and they think they're Adonis or whatever, you know, they feel like their muscles are really, and like somebody look at them and go, I didn't know you did any weights. You don't look like it. But they said, yeah, I do weights. They might look quite lean. It helped their lean mass to hang around. But you don't. You clearly do not lift stuff. And when people say, and I try not to smirk, when people say, yeah, I lift, but I can't lift too much because I put on too much lean mass. And I just think you're kidding yourself.
Okay.
You cannot do it.
As someone said to me, a Tic Tac looks big strapped to a matchstick. As I got my legs out.
Yeah.
But another little thing that I've noticed has made a difference for me is eating regularly. So your body doesn't then go, well, when am I going to get fed again?
Yeah.
I'm not fat by any, you know, I hardly carry any weight, but what happens, yeah, I know, I know, Joseph. I'm wrong side of 30 now, aren't I? But what happens is if you eat regularly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm talking, you know, you have your breakfast at 8, for instance. You then maybe have a snack at 11. You then have your dinner at 1. You have a snack at 3.
Yeah.
You go home and have your tea at 6.
Yeah.
You know, these.
But that doesn't mean you're in a calorie surplus.
No.
You're just in a regular calorie status.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what happens is your body's so clever. What it works out is if you then go from 8 to...
It says power bar. Oh, it's 11 o'clock.
Well, that's it. That's what I'm saying. But if it goes from like 8 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon, you go, oh, I've got to have my dinner. Your body's already gone. We ain't going to get fed here. We're not going to get fed. So
is that what it says? That exact language?
Effectively,
we ain't going to get fed here.
We ain't going to get fed.
Wow.
Sunshine.
It goes catabolic.
Yeah. So what it wants to do then is it's kind of going, right, well, the next time we have a meal, we're going to have to store some up because I don't know when it's going to come in again. But if you
is
eat,
that what it says?
Joe, honestly, I can hear the words now as I'm sat here when I ate my dinner at 5 o'clock today.
I did give you a protein bar, didn't I?
I am piling on the weight as we're sat here.
Yeah, no, I gave you a protein bar. I said, if you need to eat anything before we start the podcast.
Not halfway through, speaking with your mouthful.
Through. Yeah.
But that's made a hell of a difference to me, is being able to eat regularly.
Yeah.
All right, the portion size for me, I love to eat, but the portion size have come down a bit, but the quality of the food that I'm eating now is good. Where I'm not cramming it full of protein, but there's a nice little mix between everything. I'm not hungry all the time. So, you know, effectively, it makes then a hell of a difference to your training.
Yeah.
Because you can have proper training sessions, not get on the turbo and go, well, I could only just muster up a sandwich at lunchtime. You'll get on that turbo and want to hit, for instance, if you're doing high-intensity training, you want to hit those figures, yeah. Ain't going
to
happen.
Don't anybody listen to this, take this wrong, but there was a very good article in 220 about the whole weight issue.
Yes, yeah.
And a lot of athletes and people contributed to it. And it was very good because it talked about something that, you know, sometimes people use exercise as a way of... you've got to be slightly on the side of... I'm conscious... last night I had half a tub of Ben and Jerry's.
You're outrageously...
outrageously gross. Yeah, I've dropped weight and I'm eating like that. But at the same time, most of the time, I'm conscious of just eating properly.
Yes.
And
yeah.
just saying, well, look, if I don't eat properly, I cannot pretend that I'm still going to stay at a shape of sort of athletic sort of ability that I'm happy with. If you put on the weight, oh, I'm going slow because I'm heavy. So you can't switch off or it will catch up with you. However, what you don't want to do is turn it into a real, you know, there are people that this article said have come out the other end, have said it just ended up being, you know, every bit of food was considered to be, you know, like a sin, and everything I did was always towards my weight. And, you know, it's you put novice in brackets after the bit that you're on about. And that's what, you know, the elites have to go through some pretty horrific things at times. But I don't think amateur athletes should watch it as specifically. And they've got to really be mindful that, you know what, I'm doing this as part of fun. And if fun means
that I
go to the fridge, I go to the benders, go, oh no, I can't do that just in case it makes me slower. It's like, no, live a bit, because you cannot obsess to the point that it starts becoming a real issue that has got then actually detrimental effects to your performance, to your happiness, to your want to do the sport anymore.
Yeah, that's it, exactly.
If you balance it right and you do this regular meal thing, well, yeah, perhaps there could have been, you know, a very perfect fruit salad combination with a lot more nutrients instead of that. But I'd already had fruit in the day and I don't eat Ben and Jerry's every night and I wanted it and I was pleased about what I'd done over the past few weeks. I thought, I'm going to have a bit of that actually. Yeah. And the kids aren't going to have that. I'm going to have it. And
the kids are locked in the cupboard starving now.
But it's that balance thing that you've got to... I always think it is about balance. Sometimes you've got to say, no, you know what, I've really got to keep a kind of lid on this, or else I could really start to... And often it's the things that you more crave that you've got to watch. But that doesn't mean that you can't have certain foods.
No.
It's important to see that it's not a reward, it's just balance. To say, yeah, I can eat really good and I'll have my oats and I'll have my grapes and I'll have my, you know, my this and that, but also I'll have some ice cream.
Yeah.
Or I'll have a... I mean, I'm not really a drinker, but oh, I'll have a beer or a wine or whatever. Keep it in balance, and if you can or can't, you know what? The scales are going to tell you eventually whether you can or can't.
They do not lie.
They do not lie. Plus, your ability to be able to, when somebody says, "Oh, do you want to?" You know, "Oh, it's a hot evening." And somebody says, "Your wife or your boyfriend or your girlfriend," someone says, "Oh, do you want one of these ciders?" And you sort of go, oh, that's a brilliant idea. You can't say, oh, I can't have any of that.
Because
you know, oh, that's alcohol or whatever. There has to be a balance to this. And the runner background is often the place where a lot of people with weight issues, because weight is the fundamental principle on which you can measure performance.
Yeah.
So, of course, the lighter you get, the more likely you are to run faster than the next person.
I think that's exactly right. Like it said in the message there, you know, in brackets, novice. Well, to be honest, unless you're being paid to do a sport, we're all novices, aren't we? Really, in the grand scale of things. I wouldn't give up kind of the lifestyle that I've got, you know, by not having certain things. And don't get me wrong, you can get obsessed, absolutely calorie obsessed. With everything, and I could do that easily. I can work out what I have a day, but to be honest, it's like tonight. I'll go home. I have to eat. There's no two ways about it. So I'll go home, and I might only rustle up a sandwich, you know, and it'll have one of the sins in, which is cheese. cheese apparently is the no-no. It's everything that's bad in the world.
According to somebody, it
is. Yeah, according to somebody, that is the big... The cheese is no-no. I love cheese. I could eat cheese on its own forever. I'd have gout, but there you go. Along with red wine. But don't let it overtake you to the point where you are going to get obsessed with it. Mm. If you're going to get obsessed with it, I think at that point, you need to turn around and you put your hands up and go, you know, I'm just going to back off a bit. Yeah. You know, and I mean, I had a McDonald's the other day, and that was the first time in probably a year that I've had a McDonald's. And I sat there, and even afterwards, I just did that. Oh, God, that was awful.
Do you know what? I had a McDonald's for the first time, and my son, who is 5 and a half, had not been to McDonald's. So I have had a McDonald's no more frequent than 6 years ago.
Yeah, I know.
And it was all right. And it wouldn't be something I'd say, I'd want to do that often. But I didn't think, oh, no, I can't go to McDonald's. Of course you can.
I'm going to have to run home. Seth, you're driving.
If you think that things are bad, they are.
They are.
They are.
It's got to that point.
If you think they're good, they are. But if you put things in categories of definitely good and definitely bad, you could eat enough grapes to give you some problem. You could, you know, drink enough energy drinks to have some problems.
Yeah, yeah.
You could, you know, you could eat just the right amount of McDonald's, or there are other food brands available, and they'd be fine.
Yeah.
It's within the balanced perspective.
That's
so
it.
You've got to look at, am I taking lots of different nutrients in? What am I trying to do? I'm trying to get stronger on the bike, or I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to run well, but still be a biker. Well, look at what people do that are duathletes, and look at how, you know, how you can improve over time by tweaking a few things. But it is all about balance.
Exactly. Exactly.
Have you got any more notes, Martin?
No, that is it. I am done.
Oh, cool. That's a.
I have seamlessly woven them into our conversation.
I know. But it was very awesome. Impressive that you had them all folded up nice and neatly, put down the back of your iPhone case.
The reason why I had to do that is because I knew for a fact that I would leave them behind.
Right.
I would have been distraught.
The listeners are so pleased you bought them.
Not. They just. That boy's a buffoon.
The boy's a buffoon. Okay, so I think we are coming near to another hour and a quarter's fun-filled jollity. This is the April edition, so we are at the beginning of the season. Whatever you do, do something that is a bit different to just normal training. Too many people get scared about starting their first race or going to a race or completing an event. You are in a minority by the fact that you're on the starting line.
Exactly.
And it's often the precursor to doing another one and to seeing where you're at and to, you know, learning something about yourself and sometimes saying, well, actually, I didn't think, you know, lo and behold, I wasn't that far off what I thought I might do. If I haven't done that much training, well, that tells you how much maybe training's ever done for you.
Well, that's it, yeah.
You know, and also this is the time of year where, you know, you can, with more daylight and ideally with increasing temperatures, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, that you can actually start to do some longer sessions and start to enjoy your training. If you've not been able to, you know, put that good a winter together, well, great. Do stuff now. Get yourself in an event. Choose a target. Even if it's just to get round, that is a great way of you having something to work for.
Yeah.
And nobody gets to the start and not say, oh, I'm not quite sure. That's why it's a competition. It's got a question mark in it. Because you don't know what's going to happen. If you knew what was going to happen, it would be pointless going to a race. You might have a slight better race than you thought, and lo and behold, you beat somebody that's always beaten you.
Yep.
Or actually, you know what? That course didn't get the better of you, and you didn't have to walk up the final climb, and you ran up there. Or it was a really fun event, and you really got into it. But until you get there, there's a multitude of little gremlins that can stop people with 5 days to go, or with 5 hours to go, and they won't go to an event thinking that, oh, well, you know, I might not beat this person, or I might not be as good. Just get and do it, because the moment you've done it, unless you require far more of yourself than you're ever going to be able to deliver, and that's a little having a word with yourself. Actually, you've probably achieved something or done something that most people won't do. It's something with which you can be proud of the effort you've put in, or say afterwards, right, that is the reason why I need to pull my finger out, because that's a diabolical thing. But you know what? Like Crocker's diary thing earlier on, the writing was already on the wall. I need to get more consistent and write things down. Not obsess about it. Enjoy it, I love this time of year because I think there's lots of unknowns ahead of us, but there's lots of potential.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And again, if you rock up on a start line and you think training hasn't gone well, I've had a nightmare of a winter, it doesn't get any worse. It's never going to get any worse, is it?
Yeah.
You know, if
yeah.
everything then starts to go well, yeah. it's always going to get better.
Yeah. And be realistic, and somebody might have had a better time, and your scenario, your life at that point might have had some, you know, some really bad turns or some really inconsistent health or whatever. Fine. You know, yours, everybody has, which is, you get the good times and it's great when it's happening and it's really good to appreciate it and it rolls along and you think, wow, I'm invulnerable. And then suddenly something hits you from the side and you go, wow, oh, I've you know, this has happened. I'm only just getting back. But don't think then that you have to, you know, sneak off to the sidelines and never race. The real character in people is the ones that do it, even if they're not at what they think of as to be peak performance. And the worst people are the ones that, if they don't feel like they're doing good, they either don't turn up, or halfway through they drop out, or they'll always have a list of excuses pre-prepared of what went wrong. Just do it and think, I am so lucky to have the ability, the time, the freedom, and the, you know, the wherewithal to do this. And you know what? Next time, if I do a little bit more work or I do things properly, I might get a bit better. But you know what? The house is still going to be there when I get home.
Yeah.
The kids can eat, or, you know, the cat,
still going to have to work.
The cat will get fed. I'll still have to go to work on Monday morning. It's really nice to think about, you know, endurance sports as your own challenge, not to get certain times or to be put in a certain category of greatness, but actually to learn about you. And sometimes the stark truth about race performances is they slap you around the face and tell you about how you have been actually kidding you about how much you think you can do. You know what? The champions shine very quickly, and the people that can enjoy it, even if they're in the back quarter of the race, can still enjoy it, sometimes be more relaxed, and sometimes not be het up about, you know, things that are totally unimportant, because it's great to be in such a positive environment with so many other people on the start line at the end that just love the fact that they're in a positive environment.
Well, that's the thing. And there'll be plenty of people out there that, one, can't do what you are doing.
Yeah.
And two, there are plenty of people out there that want to spoil what you are doing. So
yeah,
you just keep on doing what you're doing.
Keep on trucking.
Keep on.
Okay, newsletter, sign up at jbst.com. In between the podcasts, the Twitter feed will have various things about athlete lessons from achievements that they've done, updates on research or things like that.
We haven't had any of your research papers.
No, I was just keeping it different this time. No, I just don't want to go over the top, or else there'll be a thing about, oh, it's too much research. Not a question. Not enough questions. Too much research. But yeah, I'll do a few. There's been a few not ground rocking things, but a few things that are you know, just reconfirming or aligning certain things. Facebook page, you can ask your questions. I think it's facebook.com/coachjoebeer, something along those lines. You can tweet Martin at
Southwark Racing.
At Southwark Racing.
At Southwark Racing.
Yeah.
And I will get to them if I can, I promise.
We'll get to them if I can. Well, there's a commitment, isn't there? If I can. When I can. Well, I might do. So remember, you know, it's not only about training smart, it's about getting to the start line. Sometimes just getting to somewhere where you're helping other people do races and, you know, holding a flag on a corner or doing a stopwatch or giving somebody...
We wouldn't be able to do it if it wasn't for those guys.
And we will be back in a few weeks' time when the season will be well and truly underway. The
season will be vastly upon us.
You can tell us all about your mountain biking then.
Probably not.
You're going to say a last-minute comment?
I
thought you'd have one written down. One of those gems. Give us one of those gems. Come on.
No, I think I'm done.
One of those gems you said earlier.
But one of the gems is... hang on a minute. I can't find it now. I've got it.
Wait, listeners. Get ready. Right. Close your eyes. Well, no, not if you're driving. But just if you sat down and you can, listen to Martin's absolute golden nugget of wisdom.
Just remember, more info doesn't mean better informed.
This is a... Mic test. Take it, mic.
Test 2 2 1 1 2 2 2 1 2.
Two.
You should honestly see if you can make a face.